Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, delighted to welcome back to our studios Kate Jerome, who is on the faculty of the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College, a well-known lawn and garden expert here in southeastern Wisconsin. And she joins us from time to time to answer any questions that you might have about your own lawn or garden. So we want to invite your questions, either via email or over the telephone, if you would like to direct a question to Kate Jerome. Our phone number here at WGTD is 564-8450, 564-8450. The area code is 262 if you are listening from someplace afar. And you can also send me an email if you like. And I'd like you to use my Carthage email address, which is gberg@carthage.edu, gberg@carthage.edu. And either way, Kate Jerome is happy to answer your question. We actually have quite a raft of questions that have already come to us via email. So we'll be getting around to all of those as well, of course. And Kate has a number of different suggestions for this time of year, which is a very, very busy time for gardeners. So we have lots to talk about. And Kate Jerome, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Good to have you here. I know that ahead of answering any questions, we want to make sure to give you plenty of time to talk about a couple of different things that, in a sense, are on the calendar, beginning with the Urban Farm Market. First of all, remind our listeners about what that is.
The Urban Farm Market is a farm market where you can buy the best, freshest, organically grown produce. We have pasture-raised eggs. We have local honey. We have all kinds of vegetable, herb, and flower plants available. And our farm market is open here on the Gateway campus at the Pike Creek Horticulture Center on Thursdays from 1 to 6. It is open to the public every single Thursday. We have live music. We have kids' activities. We have garden clinics. This week, our garden clinic is on preserving herbs. And that, the garden clinics are offered at 1:30 and 5:30, free to the public. So come stop in and have a chat with one of our experts.
Very good. And help people understand who've never been there exactly how to find you.
If you come to the Kenosha campus, which is right on 30th Avenue, just come in one of the northern entrances and go west to the greenhouses. You'll see the greenhouses, and there's plenty of parking right there, and that's where our farm stand is. There will be a flag at the curb to the entrance to campus that says farm stand, so you'll be able to see it. Farm market, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And a really, really big plant sale is also coming up really shortly.
Right. This coming Saturday is our big blowout summer plant sale, and we are sharing the venue with the Wild Ones, which is a group of native plant aficionados, and they will be selling trees and shrubs and perennials and native, all natives. And then for our own part of the plant sale, we have all of our annual flowers for sale. We have heirloom vegetable plants. We have herbs, a little bit of everything. And that is this Saturday, June 4th, from 9 to 2, again at the Pike Creek Center.
Fantastic.
We're very excited about it. Lots of beautiful things. The greenhouses are packed full right now, so it should be a lot of fun.
And you were saying this is really prime planting season, at least when it comes to a lot of things, so this is well-timed.
It's well-timed. This is the time when all the tomatoes and peppers and everything can go out, so it is time to kick into gear.
Very good. Well, as I said, we have quite a number of questions that have already come via email that we're going to get to, but we want to also put you on the air to speak directly with Kate Jerome. We want to remind you that our phone number here at WGTD is 564-8450, 564-8450. The area code is 262. If you would like to call and speak directly on the air with Kate Jerome, that's really the best way to do it, because if she has questions for you in terms of follow-up or clarification, we can kind of have a little conversation about whatever it is that might be ailing your garden or lawn. So please feel free to give us a call if you like, 564-8450. Don't be shy. Kate, let's get going with the first question that's come to us from Kari in Racine. She's wondering, what is a quick-growing deciduous tree that has pretty fall foliage, does well in clay soil, and can withstand the wind? Let me say all that one more time. A quick-growing deciduous tree that has pretty fall foliage, does well in clay soil, and can withstand the wind. Any thoughts?
My favorite for a situation like that is a Freeman maple. It is a hybrid maple between a red and a silver maple. Silver maples are very fast-growing, and we don't like them because they tend to be breakable. They break their branches easily, but they've bred this plant. It's actually a naturally occurring hybrid for the best parts of the red maple and the best parts of the silver maple. So it grows very quickly. It has stunning red fall color. Absolutely gorgeous. It's just, there's one called Autumn Sunset that is just amazing. And it'll withstand drought. It withstands water. So it is very tolerant of clay soil. And it basically has sturdy enough leaves that they don't get tattered in the wind.
Hmm. What was that called again?
Freeman maple. F-R-E-E-M-A-N. And I think it's a... they're starting to appear. We're starting to see them even as street trees. And anything that's planted as a street tree, you know, is going to be sturdy. Mm. So it's a great choice for the landscape.
Very good. Sounds like a good suggestion. And another question that came in somewhat similar. This is for Jean from Racine. She needs a clean tree for next to her driveway. In other words, one that does not drop stuff onto the driveway, and yet would look nice right in front of the house. Any suggestions for a so-called clean tree for a setting like that?
Well, it depends on how much space you have. First of all, most a tree's normal life cycle is to flower and then set some kind of fruit and then drop that fruit to start the next generation. So finding a tree that doesn't have that is virtually impossible. Hmm. So what we look for is a tree that holds on to its fruit for a long time, maybe through the winter, or the birds take them. Birds or squirrels will take the fruit instead of having them fall. If there's room, one of my suggestions would be a serviceberry, which has a very attractive spring flower. It puts on sort of a red to purple, very sweet fruit, which we can eat too. And you can, if you beat the birds to it, it's delicious.
But what was that called again?
It's called a serviceberry.
Hmm.
And there are many different varieties. There are some that are multiple-stemmed, single-stemmed. Some are just look like a standard, a single trunk and then a kind of a round top. Some of them are more broad. It just depends on the variety and depends on the kind of space you have. It tolerates sun and it tolerates shade, which is another good feature of it. And it has very attractive fall color. So it's a nice, smaller urban tree. It's not going to be a huge shade tree, but it gives you beauty, and it's a fairly clean tree. The birds get the fruit so fast they don't have time to fall.
Ah.
So, and it's actually fun to watch because the birds and the squirrels will be in the tree sort of fighting over the fruit, and they're hanging around and making lots of noise, and it's a lot of fun to watch them. But they're eating the fruit, so it doesn't fall and make mess on your driveway.
Ah, very good. And I didn't stop to think about that's why so many trees do that, because that's the only way you get more trees.
That's right.
Very good.
That's right.
Well, good suggestion. So a service berry tree. A question from Steve in Racine. This is a question that has come up from time to time, but it's always a good thing to talk about. What are some non-toxic ways to control weeds and help the grass to grow a little fuller? Some non-toxic ways to control weeds and help grass grow fuller.
Well, first of all, on the grass growing fuller, the best thing you can do is to mow it high. Mow it at 3 or 4 inches. It's a little different look than we're used to, that short cropped, golf course style lawn. Mow it a little bit higher, and then it will be better able to choke out the weeds, to shade out the weeds. As far as weed control itself, two ways that are pretty effective, but they take some time, are vinegar and hot water. You can actually take a kettle of hot water and pour it in the crown of the weeds. What you're doing is cooking it. it doesn't hurt anything around it. It'll kill anything it touches. I mean, but if you just pour it right in the crown of the weed, this is spot treatment. Same with the vinegar. You can use household vinegar. You can also purchase horticulture vinegar, which is a little bit stronger acid. And we purchase horticulture vinegar from Amazon, so it's very widely available. You may have to treat a couple of times, but what it does, again, it's an acid, so it expands the cells and bursts them, and so it kills the plant. You pour it right in the crown of the plant.
So that's a vinegar you would never use the way you use other vinegar? It's prepared in a particular
It's just a stronger acid. You wouldn't put it on your salad. No, it's too strong. Right. And you do need to use gloves and have eye protection when you put it down because it is it's a stronger acid. But otherwise, household vinegar, white vinegar is very inexpensive. It's like $2 for a gallon of that, and it's very effective.
Mm. Very good. Good suggestions. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, feel free to email it at gberg@carthage.edu, G-B-E-R-G at carthage.edu. Or better yet, give us a phone call here at WGTD 564-8450, 564-8450. I'll be happy to put you right on the air directly with Kate Jerome. Kate, a question about someone who has a clematis that needs to be moved. She's wondering what is the best time of year to do that.
If it hasn't started leafing out, you could do it this time of year, but otherwise I would wait until the fall. And they really do best if you cut them back and then move them. Just cut back all the stems and everything and then move them. So I think most clematis are on their way right now. So I think they're in full leaf. So I think you'd be better off waiting until the fall to transplant it.
Waiting till the fall. A P.S. in this question, she asks you to make mention of a program which apparently you're going to be doing at the Kenosha Public Museum on Thursday the 16th.
Right. I'm doing the Steam Cafe at noon. I'll be talking about vermicomposting, so I'll have my worms with me. So come join us.
So tell me about the Steam Cafe.
It's a just an informational session series that the Kenosha Museum is running. I don't know the dates, but they're right over the lunch hour, and so they encourage you to bring a box lunch with you and enjoy.
Very good. So Kate Jerome is there at the Kenosha Public Museum on Thursday the 16th, right at 12 noon. Gold for your garden from worms. Okay. I like the title, like the topic. It's 25 minutes after 8 o'clock. This is the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and with me in the studio, Kate Jerome, who is a member of the horticulture faculty here at Gateway Technical College, here to answer any questions that you might have about your lawn or your garden. Feel free to give us a call at 564-8450, 564-8450, or send an email to gberg@carthage.edu. And one way or another, we'll be happy to pose your question to Kate Jerome. Okay, Kate, let's keep going with all these questions that have already come in. Lots to talk about today. This is a question from Rita in Kenosha. she says, this is for a question for those of us who are black-thumbed versus green-thumbed. What would you say, what are some of the easiest plants to maintain for the summer, virtually kill-proof?
Petunias.
Ah.
I know, I had a quick answer for that. If you're looking for flowers, petunias, marigolds, they take no care. Marigolds occasionally have to cut off the dead heads just to keep them blooming. Petunias do that themselves. They're both very drought tolerant, so if you forget to water, they're fine. Geraniums are in that same boat. All of them will need full sun. That's the one caveat. They can't be grown well in the shade. But all of them are very drought tolerant, and surprisingly, even your black thumb will be able to grow them.
Very good. Well, let's hope that works. Very good. Here's a question from Heather in Kenosha. She's wondering about the best way to start herbs from seeds. She mentioned specifically basil, cilantro, parsley. She says right now that they're in full sun pots on our deck. And she's also wondering what's the best choice in terms of potting soil. So
let's start off with potting soil. You want to make sure, if you're putting it in a container outside, that you buy a high quality potting soil. If you buy a lower quality, it tends to be very heavy, and you don't want it so heavy that it keeps the plant roots too wet and rots them.
I'm just curious. So what does that distinction even mean? When you say high quality and low quality, does it say it on the bag?
It doesn't say it on the bag, but this says it on the price.
Okay.
So it's a little daunting sometimes, but the lower priced, lower end, many times the store brands are not quite as good as some of the national brands. And I normally wouldn't say that, but it's true because they just have higher quality materials in them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely worth paying a little bit more for high quality potting soil. And the nice thing is that if you're growing containers on the deck, on the patio, you don't have to change that soil out every year. You just take out about the top inch of it, leave it over winter, just let it sit there, take out the top inch in the spring and put fresh potting soil in, and then you can still use that same potting soil as long as you are good about fertilizing, which you have to be in a container anyway because the plant can't take its roots out and find its nutrients. You need to provide it.
Mm-hmm.
Starting herbs from seed is actually quite simple. The only one that might give you a little trouble is the parsley seed because it takes a long time to germinate. But when you're going to plant parsley, take the seed and soak it just in a glass of water for 24 hours in warm water. And that will help start breaking down that seed coat so it'll germinate a little faster. Otherwise, it's just a matter of sprinkling them on top of the potting soil, pressing them in lightly and making sure you keep it moist until the little plants are up, which means putting plastic over it or something to keep that moisture in. If you're starting them outdoors, you've got to be really vigilant because if they start to germinate and then dry out, then the seed will die.
Mm.
So you have to be pretty careful about it.
So very, very loving to your herbs. Very good. Let's see here. Question from Michael, who is in Northern Illinois. He's wondering, how easy is it to do a soil test on your lawn? And maybe it might make sense in conjunction with that question to maybe just talk a moment about why somebody would want to do a soil test on their lawn. What would the purpose be, and how does one go about doing that?
Well, if you have concerns about your soil, then it's definitely worth doing a soil test. I have mixed feelings about it. Sometimes a soil test reveals good information. Sometimes it gives you not much information. To do a soil test on a lawn, the best way to do it is to take a shovel and literally slice off a piece of the sod and just set it aside and then take a scoop of the soil that's beneath it. If you can do this in two or three spots in the lawn and then mix the soil together in a plastic bag and you can send it off to the state lab. The county extension will take that and has all the forms and information that you can to put with your soil sample, and then you send. I'm not sure what the cost is. It was $18 a couple years ago, and I'm not sure if it's gone up. But they'll send it off, and then you'll get a report back from the state lab that tells you what nutrients you have available, what your pH is, and the amount of organic matter you have in the soil. The best part about that is that they will then give you recommendations on how to amend it, how to make things a little bit better. So that's a good thing. You can do a home test. Home tests are available in hardware stores. They're not as accurate, of course, but it can give you a decent reading, but it doesn't come with the recommendations on what to do about it.
Mm.
So you have the information. You need to know what to do about it.
Right. If there's a problem, if there's a deficiency, it's nice to know how to address it.
If you're worried about toxic chemicals or toxic elements like lead in your soil, the state can also do that for an additional fee. That is something that if you are concerned about it, you should definitely have your soil tested because it's not worth risking, especially if you're going to grow food.
Hmm. Good idea. 8:30, this is The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and happy to have with me in the studios Kate Jerome, who is on the horticulture faculty here at Gateway Technical College. We're keeping her very busy answering all kinds of questions about the lawn and garden. We can add your question to the mix. The email, if you want to do that, is gberg@carthage.edu, G-B-E-R-G, gberg@carthage.edu. Otherwise, give us a call here at WGTD, 564-8450, 564-8450. We'll be happy to put you on the air directly to speak with Kate Jerome and to pose your question that way. Kate, a question in email from Leanne in Racine, it looks like. She says, I've had no luck with any variety of lavender in our backyard. I seem to follow all of the instructions for sunlight and water and have tried it from seed and from established plants. I love lavender. Is our climate just not right for lavender? Do you have any suggestions?
Lavender is one of those love-hate plants. We all love the smell of it, but it's just not as successful as we would like to see it. The English climate is perfect for lavender, of course. We can actually grow lavender here, but the one thing that is critical is that it be very dry in the winter. That's what usually kills lavender, is a soggy soil, a heavy clay soil that holds water. It just it rots it. I've grown lavender for years, and I'll grow it, and it'll be fine for 2 years or 3 years, and then it dies. And so I put in another plant, and I grow it for 2 years, and it's fine, and then it dies. So it's not one of those things that you can be assured will continue to thrive. It's very hard starting lavender from seed, so the best bet is to go with one of the cultivars. And the one that I've found that I like best is Hidcote. It's Hidcote. It's very commonly available, and it's probably one of the tougher lavenders. But it's really important that I can't say that enough, that it be dry soil in the wintertime. And it sounds like that doesn't make any sense, but it's a Mediterranean plant, and the Mediterranean climate is cold in the winter and hot in the summer, and the soil is sandy, dry for the most part. So that's what you want. You want not overwater it. That's one of the biggest problems with lavender.
So lavender is easily drowned.
Easily drowned.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Good advice for growing lavender. Kate, a question from Kate. Another Kate. Wondering if there is a weed killer and or lawn fertilizer that is safe for pets and children. I mean, if one has pets, if one has children. She is especially trying to contend with thistles. Do you have any suggestions?
Thistles are really, really hard to control. The standard broadleaf weed killer that most people use is 2,4-D, which is not safe for pets or kids. You can spot treat so that you're spraying only the weed. It's a lot of work to do that, but that's the only way to really make sure that you're not broadcasting it over the lawn. Lawn fertilizers, most of them are fine for pets and kids. That's not an issue. But if you get a lawn fertilizer that has a weed killer in it, then you need to be really careful. It's really important that we not broadcast anyway, that we just spot treat our weeds, because otherwise you're putting on a lot of chemical in areas where there aren't weeds. So you're wasting it and you're introducing a lot into the system. One of the things that I've just purchased that I'm going to try is a steam weeder.
Oh, you mentioned that last time.
Yeah, I actually am going to start experimenting. I haven't had great luck with it so far. We've tried it on the urban farm here at Gateway, and we haven't had great luck with thistles. But I'm going to stick with it and just see if it takes like three applications where you just stick this little fork in there and you give it a blast of steam and see if it works. But otherwise, thistles are really nasty, and they're very hard to get rid of. So good luck with it is all
right.
I can say.
Yeah. What would this steam thing do? I mean, what is it about that would potentially kill something like
it? It does the same thing as hot water. It basically explodes the cells. It cooks it. It cooks it just like you would, you know, pour boiling water on something. And unlike on greens, it'll wilt them and cook them.
Right.
So we're going to do that to the thistle.
Right. So you've tried it, but like once maybe, and it hasn't
right. It
done
didn't
much.
Work with one application, but I'm going to work on it and see if I can make sure it works and see if I can recommend it to people.
Well, we will look forward to hearing the results of that. A question for Kate Jerome. Give us a call at 564-8450, 564-8450. Kate, a question from Kathy in Kenosha wondering, how often should one aerate one's lawn? How often should you aerate one's lawn? And maybe for the sake of somebody who's not even acquainted with that, maybe say a word about what that involves and why it's done.
Aeration is a process where you bring in a machine called an aerator, and this machine has a roller that with spiky looking tubes, and they're not just spikes, they're actually tubes. And so as it rolls over the soil, it goes into the soil and pulls out a plug of soil and then drops it. So you've got these plugs. They actually look like you had geese in your lawn after it's done. But it pulls a plug out and it leaves a hole in the soil. And that hole then is opens up the grass sod to air and more moisture. And so it causes the roots to grow into this hole, and it just makes a healthier lawn all the way around. Hmm. It's best done if you have a thatch problem, which is a really deep layer of brown peat moss looking material right underneath the grass crown. It doesn't happen because of lawn clippings. It happens usually because of over-fertilization. The grass just grows and grows and grows, and it can't completely decompose all of its extra stuff, and so it makes this thatch layer. If you have a thatch layer, it means the water doesn't get through. You come in and aerate, you're pulling out little holes in this thatch layer, so it allows the water and the air to get in. So that's why we aerate. If you have heavy thatch, aeration is definitely going to help your lawn. If you don't have a lot of thatch, it'll help a certain amount, but it's not something you need to do frequently. Generally, if it's a heavy thatched lawn, you should do it every year for at least 2 years, maybe 3 years. If you have a fairly decent lawn, you can do it once every 5 years and you're fine. Fall is the best time to do it. Actually, the grass is growing very strong in the fall. The soil is warm, so you're better off doing that in the fall instead of in the spring.
Very good. Question from someone in Kenosha. What kind of grass will grow under a shady oak tree? So under kind of heavy shade, is there any kind of grass that one can get that's going to do a little better in a setting like that?
The standard grass for shade is called red fescue. It is a shade grass, but red fescue is never going to be very thick. And if you have heavy shade, you are never going to have a thick lawn underneath it. It's just something that you have to just realize this, that the grass needs at least some sun to grow. So you could try the red fescue, but my general recommendation when you have a shade tree underneath to put a bed with mulch or hostas or a ground cover or something that will tolerate heavy shade. One of the other problems that you have in a shady situation like that is you have competition, and so the grass is competing with tree roots for water and everything else.
Didn't think about that.
Right. So a sturdier ground cover that will tolerate shade, or just a nice bed, take the bed right out to the edge of the tree, the drip line of the tree, and fill it with mulch, and then you'll stop worrying about it.
Sounds like good advice, very good advice. By the way, Kate, we heard from somebody who would appreciate knowing the address of the Pike Creek Center. And again, that's where the huge plant sale is coming up this Saturday.
Right, it's 3520 30th Avenue.
Which is essentially the address of the whole Gateway,
the whole school, right.
Gateway campus. And this is, again, kind of towards the south and the west of the campus, right?
Right, right. It's about central and west. So if you come in the south entrance, you can't get to the Pike Creek Center because the road doesn't go through there. There's construction.
Okay.
So you need to come in one of the two north entrances. I think there are four entrances on campus, or three. It's hard to remember.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah, yeah.
Come in one of the two north entrances, and that'll take you right back. You can see the greenhouses. Just head to the west.
Right. If you've ever been to the multi-purpose building, which is actually where WGTD used to be, it's
right. The Madrigrano Auditorium is right across the street from us,
right.
and we're back onto the Bradford baseball fields. So if that gives you a sense of where you are,
very good. The time is exactly 8:40. We're having a busy morning show with Kate Jerome, a member of the horticulture faculty here at Gateway Technical College. And we've been busy answering all kinds of questions, and we'd love to answer your question as well. Please give us a call at 564-8450, 564-8450, or send us an email. I'm using my Carthage address today, gberg@carthage.edu, G-B-E-R-G, gberg@carthage.edu. We'd love to hear from you, and I'd love to pose your question to Kate Jerome, or do it yourself over the phone at 564-8450. Kate, a question from Wayne, wondering how best to get rid of grubs and Japanese beetles.
Oh. Well, there are two different kinds of grubs. The Japanese beetle grub is different than the annual white grub, so you have to distinguish between, because the methods for killing Japanese beetle grubs is different than killing annual grubs. The same products do not work for both. There is a product you can purchase called Milky Spore Disease that will help take care of the annual grubs. Japanese beetle grubs, there's one called Grub X, I think. I guess I would suggest just going to the garden store and looking for methods to take care of the grubs. As far as the adults, the Japanese, first of all, the annual grub adult is that June beetle that we see, that brown June beetle, which is harmless. It doesn't do anything except stick to your screens and stick to your hair.
Oh, the big, ugly brown ones.
The ones that are always laying on their backs.
Right. But they don't hurt anything.
They don't hurt anything. They don't do anything. Hmm. Japanese beetles can be devastating to plants, so that's one that it's harder to just ignore them. And the best thing you can do, as much as if you're squeamish, it's going to be hard, is to take a bucket of soapy water and just go out in the really cool morning when everything is, when they're very sluggish, and just pick them off or knock them into that bucket. It's very effective. If they're up in the trees, not so effective. But you can actually shake, you put a cloth down and shake the tree. But you have to do this when they're still sluggish in the very cool part of the morning. Mm. And then they'll fall, and then you just gather them up, and you either step on them or dispose of them somehow. But the soapy water breaks the outer film and that keeps them healthy, and so they die as soon as they're in the bucket. So,
wow.
Or you can pay neighborhood kids a penny a beetle.
I remember so vividly 2 or 3 years ago walking out into my yard, and actually the reason I was out there was because we had a little bird's nest, and I was checking on the bird's nest, and then I saw all of these insects all over the bushes there, and I was just horrified at the sight, and that was the first time then I think I directly posed the question to you, and I got that advice about soapy bucket of water, and it does work.
It does, and we've seen the Japanese beetle populations have been really high. They were really high 5 years ago, and they're starting to gradually decline. So nature's kicking in and getting us back to a balance. But it's still very annoying when they're taking down your roses or your raspberries. So
absolutely. Well, and there was something about just seeing it. I mean, just seeing these beetles and seeing them just eating the leaves right in front of your face. And I also thought it was kind of cool to actually be the direct agent of removing them. I mean, that actually, I mean, you're right, you can't be squeamish, but it felt good to do it.
It's very self-fulfilling to be able to squash slugs and squash
or like you see what you're doing. I mean, as opposed to maybe applying something and then you wait and you hope. It's like, I know that one's dead and that one's dead and that one's
dead.
did the soul world of good.
I should mention before the Japanese beetle, this is sometimes confused. The Japanese beetle is not the red spotted lady beetle. It is a green metallic looking beetle that's a little bit kind of large, as large as your thumbnail. It's not the smaller bugs. The smaller ones are annoying, but they do no harm to your plants.
Right. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, please give us a call at 564-8450 or feel free to send an email to gberg, G-B-E-R-G, gberg at carthage.edu. From email from Sharon, she says, I know it's an old problem, but what is your top suggestion for eliminating creeping Charlie?
Learn to love it.
Oh, boy.
Creeping Charlie is very hard to get rid of. There are a lot of home remedies out there, most of which are not effective. The only thing that's really effective is 2,4-D, which is toxic and is not something you want to apply and then have kids or pets out on your lawn. Mm-hmm. It goes away fairly quickly, but it's a chemical, and so that's really the only way. The only effective way, as far as home remedies, safe ways, you can try vinegar on it. But the problem is it runs so far that you've got to get the whole plant, and that's almost impossible with spot treatment. Mm. So it's not an easy fix. I have learned to live with it in my lawn. It's green. I just mow my lawn, and it smells good when I mow the Creeping Charlie, and I just live with it.
Mm. What does Creeping Charlie look like?
It has a sort of a round, scalloped leaf on it, and it has on long vines, and so it runs and runs and runs into your flower beds and everything else. So, and a small little purple flower. So it's actually not a bad-looking plant. It's just not grass. It's not what people want in their lawns, just like violets. Violets are actually very attractive plants, and we cultivate violets, but most people don't want them in their lawn, so they try and get rid of them. But it's changing your mindset.
Right. Kate, another question. Thoughts on keeping bunnies, birds, and other critters out of one's garden this summer? That's probably a fairly big question.
It's a very big question. The only effective way for all critters is to fence for birds, you're going to have to put up bird netting. There's no way to keep them out of the garden. And you have to be very careful that you don't injure them or put up netting or fencing that they can get under. I don't know why you'd want to keep birds out of your garden, frankly, because they're incredible predators. The ones that eat, that are meat eaters, the worms and that sort of thing. Yes, they do eat earthworms, but they eat a lot of other bugs, so they're really good to have in the garden. Mm. They're good predators. And the seed eaters shouldn't be doing any damage. Occasionally they'll go after little seedlings, but then you just put a cover over them and they'll leave those alone.
Mm-hmm.
Bunnies, there are repellents out there. People say that blood meal tends to work. Using animal or human hair works, but most of those you have to reapply after rain or you have to kind of manage, and they're not always effective. So the best thing you can do is just fence them out.
What is blood meal?
Blood meal, it's a byproduct of the slaughtering industry, which is kind of gross, but it's just basically dried blood, and it smells like a human, and so they won't come near it. It works as a repellent.
Ah, interesting. Never heard of that. Blood meal.
Blood meal.
And you would buy that in a garden center?
Just buy it in a garden center. It's also a source of nitrogen, so it's a fertilizer as well.
Wow, fascinating. Very good. Okay, Kate, let's see. Oh, this is an intriguing question. This emailer is... curious, he has observed a huge number of yellow jackets this spring, more than he can ever remember seeing. Have you seen that as well? And would you have any explanation for why there would be an especially high number of yellow jackets?
I have no idea. I haven't seen that many when I've been out. Evidently, some part of the cycle, some part of the ecology of the predators that keep the populations lower is missing. So, you know, nature does that. The populations go up and come down. I would keep an eye out. They're fine this year, time of year. They don't do any harm. They don't bother you this time of year. But in fall, this is when they get aggressive, and that's when you have to really watch, follow them to their holes in the ground.
Very good.
Take care of the nest.
All right. Very good. Kate, we have a call.
Yes.
Caller, go ahead. You're on the air with Kate Jerome.
I am?
You are.
You are.
Kate, first of all, I'd like to make a recommendation. People that want to get rid of weeds is that they pull them.
Great recommendation.
Or dig them out. It can be a lot of fun.
It's healthy.
You get a lot accomplished, and you learn a lot about plants.
great advice.
I mean, if you never dig a dandelion, you're never going to know what that root's like.
That's true.
I was wondering about chlorophyll. We know that chlorophyll gum is green. Are there different colors of chlorophyll, like plants that are variegated or have yellow leaves and things like that? How do they produce their food? Is their chlorophyll a different color? Do they have chlorophyll? If they do, I mean, like let's say variegated hostas as opposed to all green hostas. Do all green hostas have an advantage in producing food for themselves over a variegated hosta? And this question came to mind because I have a question about, there's a tree that grows just north of your gardens there that I believe is a type of a honey locust that's yellow.
Yellow, mm-hmm.
And would that tree be at a disadvantage in producing food for itself?
This is a great question. Chlorophyll is always green, and plants that are of different colors, except for white, the color that the like the yellow honey locust or the purple sand cherry, the color is actually masking the green. So the green is there, you just don't see it because the other color is brighter and is able to cover up that color of that chlorophyll. So they are able to make food for themselves without a problem. Plants that are white or that have white variegation tend to be a little less sturdy because they don't have quite as much chlorophyll. And if you'll notice occasionally in seed production, a plant will be produced that is all white. It's not technically an albino, but it looks like an albino plant. That plant very rarely survives because it doesn't have the chlorophyll to keep producing. So plants, the more variegation they have, the more white they have, the less sturdy they are going to be. Some of them are fine, but they're not quite as sturdy as an all-green variety.
Then I have a question, like evolutionarily speaking, why would a plant produce white foliage? or yellow or whatever?
It's usually in nature, it's just a sport. It's something that just kind of happens. It's just a genetic mutation. It's not necessarily an evolution. But then humans step in and we start reproducing that sport, that genetic mutation. We'll reproduce it and then we create plants that keep going. So it's not really evolutionary at all. It's human intervention.
That's very interesting. And what is the name of that honey locust tree?
It's called a sunburst.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate the call. And if you would like to call and pose a question directly to Kate Jerome, we would be happy to field the call while we still have time. The phone number here is 564-8450, 564-8450, if you would like to pose a question to Kate Jerome. Kate, another question that we need to give to you. Jacob is wondering about the best bushes, preferably something pretty with flowers, for shady or very limited sun and clay soil. Again, what would be the best bushes, preferably something pretty with flowers, for shady or very limited sun and clay soil?
Well, the problem comes in the shade part. Most of the ones that we know so well do very best, that have the really pretty flowers, do best in sun. But there are two groups of plants that you could investigate. One of them is the Annabelle hydrangea. It's an old-fashioned plant, and it has a nice big tropical leaf and big clusters of white flowers and grows very well in full shade. Another group of plants that you could investigate are the viburnums, and these also do well in shade, and they have various types of flowers. Most of them are white, so you're kind of stuck with white flowers. There's one other that I'm thinking that has a yellow flower that you might look into. There's a variegated variety and there's a solid green. It's called Caria, K-E-R-R-I-A. And I've seen this a little bit more frequently available in the market, so it might be something worth looking into. So hydrangea, viburnum, and the Caria.
Very good. Several different suggestions. One last call for phone calls for Kate Jerome, 564-8450, 564-8450, or an email question to gberg@carthage.edu, G-B-E-R-G, gberg@carthage.edu. Kate, I know you have some thoughts and suggestions when it comes to things that we think of as pests in the garden. Some important words to say, first of all, about bugs and to what extent we just let the bugs be there, let the bugs be bugs.
Well, it depends on the bugs. One of the most important things that you can put into your garden is your shadow. To be in that garden constantly, to be watching. If you catch things before they get out of hand, you'll go a long way to stopping any damage. So just continue to watch, learn what the pest is, identify it correctly before you go grabbing a chemical. Identify it, figure out its life cycle, and in some cases you may be able to just leave it alone and nature will take care of it. The natural predators will take care of it. So learn to live with them to somewhat, first, you know, a bit, but if they're starting to do damage to your garden, then look into ways, physical ways of covering plants or some way to keep the pests off without having to actually get out there and use something toxic.
Right. You have some interesting thoughts about mosquitoes. And does this have a lot to do with the plants, or is this more just for your own comfort as the gardener being there and maybe getting assaulted by mosquitoes?
Right. It's more the gardener being assaulted. They don't do any damage to your plants, but they can be very annoying, and they can keep you out of your garden, and that's not a good thing. So it's important that you look through your garden, make sure you don't have anything that's collecting water. The bird bath, the upturned bucket, anything that will collect water, that's the mosquito will lay their eggs in there, and the larvae will hatch very quickly. And as far as keeping them off, all of the plants that they say are mosquito repellent plants, they aren't. That's not, you know, the geranium, the mosquito geraniums, they don't repel plants. And so you have to be wise about this. They're mosquito repellents, of course. You can wear a net suit, which I have a net suit that I put over, and it just keeps the mosquitoes off of me. One of the best things, if you're entertaining, sitting on your patio, sitting on your deck, just get a good, strong fan and set that fan up, and it will blow the mosquitoes away. And then you don't even have to worry.
And you say, don't waste your money with a bug zapper.
Don't waste your money with a bug zapper. They don't work on mosquitoes. The only thing that really works on mosquitoes is a carbon dioxide machine, and they're expensive. And most people, you know, you have to. It has to be near you to be, you know, taking care of the problem. So there are ways around it. I'm hoping this isn't a bad year for them. We've been lucky so far that we haven't really had an onslaught, but they're out there.
Yeah. You mentioned that rose slugs are on the rise, and apparently this is a problem.
Rose slugs, they're called bristly rose slugs, and if you look at them under a microscope, they really do have little hairy things all over them. They're pretty gross looking. And they look, they're sort of a worm-looking critter, and they skeletonize the leaves on your roses. They don't do any damage other than just chewing the leaves a bit. They don't go after the flowers, but watch for them. They're very small at this time of year as the new leaves are coming out, so just watch again. Get yourself out into your garden, and then just put on a pair of gloves and squish them.
You mentioned Japanese beetles already. There's probably not too much more to mention about that.
We pretty well covered Japanese beetles.
I thought you gave you have some good ideas here about earwigs, which can be a problem. And you actually have a suggestion by which you can sort of attract them and then
and get
be able
rid of
to
them.
Dispose of them.
Earwigs usually come a little bit later in the season, but it as it dries out a bit, they start looking for moist places, and the moist places will be your plant pots, and they can be quite annoying, and they can actually do some plant damage if you get a high population. It's very easy to take a rolled-up newspaper, moisten it, and stick it in the garden, and they are active at night, so they'll be out in your garden, and then in the daytime they seek cover. And so they run into that newspaper, and then you just twist the ends and dispose of it.
And gone earwigs. Then, if we possibly can, you really suggest that we leave the spiders alone that are in the garden.
Spiders really are your best friends in the garden. I know it's not pleasant. I don't like spiders on me. But spiders are voracious predators, and so if you can leave them alone and not swat them, not step on them, just leave them, especially the orb spiders, the yellow ones that you see in the garden, they're absolutely gorgeous. And every time I write about spiders, I get somebody going, ew, no, I don't want spiders. But they are your friends, so leave them alone.
All right. This is a time to replenish mulch, and this is also a time to think carefully about how short your mowing your lawn.
Right. As we mentioned before, mow your lawn as high as you can possibly stand it, as high as you can tolerate. 3 to 4 inches is best, because then it shades out the weeds, and it also reduces the stress on the grass because it's got more surface area to produce food for itself. What was the other question?
The thing about replenishing mulch.
Oh, mulch time. We don't know what the summer's going to hold yet, and the soil is beginning to warm, so this is a time to think about getting mulch onto your perennials, into your vegetable garden, to keep everything healthy and to keep the water from evaporating.
And you say it's the time for houseplants to be repotted and maybe moved outdoors.
Right. If you want to move them outdoors, this is the time to do it. We're at the point where we're past 45-degree lows at night, and this is also the time to repot a houseplant. If you're going to repot, it rejuvenates it. It will make it grow. If you don't want it to grow any bigger, then don't change the pot. But if you want to repot it and rejuvenate it, then go up only an inch in size. Don't go up to a big, much bigger pot, because the plant doesn't have the roots to fill it, and you will stress it.
And we want to remind everyone of the